From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
What I saw at the polling stations in Cité Soleil yesterday morning, here during the first round of the Haitian elections at 5 in the morning, was incredibly inspiring. And what we saw throughout the day there was less mob behavior than a disenfranchisement based on people's class.
Haitians are awaiting the outcome of the first presidential election since the U.S.-backed ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide 2 years ago. We'll go to Haiti to get a report and speak with freed Haitian priest Father Gerard Jean-Just. He was temporarily released last week after more than 6 months in a Haitian jail. Then 10,000 mourners attended the funeral of civil rights pioneer Coretta Scott King. We'll play excerpts of the service, which included four U.S. presidents, poet Maya Angelou, musician Stevie Wonder, and civil rights leader the Reverend Joseph Lowry.
Her witness and character always strong, her spirit a melody from heaven's song, her beauty warm like the rays of the sun. Good night, my sister. Well done. Well done.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Haiti, voters are awaiting the outcome of the first presidential election since the U.S.-backed ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. There were no polling stations located in the Lavalas stronghold of Cité Soleil. Voters swarmed out of that poor neighborhood, as well as Bel Air and other areas, to discover voting stations had failed to open, election officials had no ballots, registration lists were incorrect, and lines stretched for blocks. Angry crowds stormed the gates of the voting stations. At least four people died, including a police officer who was killed by a mob after fatally shooting a voter. The front runner in the election is former Aristide ally René Préval. He served as Aristide's first prime minister and succeeded Aristide as president in 1996. We'll have more on the elections and speak with Father Jean-Just after headlines. In Georgia Tuesday, an estimated 10,000 people filled the pews of New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in the Atlanta suburb of Lithonia for the funeral of civil rights pioneer Coretta Scott King. Former Presidents Jimmy Carter, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and President George W. Bush attended the funeral, along with 14 U.S. senators and public figures, including Maya Angelou, Oprah Winfrey, and Stevie Wonder. King died January 30th at the age of 78, seeking treatment in Mexico for ovarian cancer. At Tuesday's service, both former President Jimmy Carter and former head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Reverend Joseph Lowry, made pointed criticism of President Bush. They cited the war in Iraq, civil liberties violations, and accused the president of ignoring the plight of the U.S. poor. We'll go to excerpts of the funeral later in the broadcast. In Afghanistan, NATO troops killed four demonstrators Tuesday as angry protests continued over the publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. NATO officials said the protesters had attacked a base in the northern town of Maimana. Meanwhile, thousands of people convened for protests in several Muslim countries, including Jordan, Egypt, and Pakistan. The Danish newspaper that originally published the 12 cartoons last September, including one that shows the Prophet Muhammad wearing a turban shaped as a bomb with a burning fuse, the cartoons were republished in European and other news media in the last week. Muslims say the images are blasphemous and contrary to Islamic tradition prohibiting depictions of the prophet. On Tuesday, the Danish Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, made a public appeal to Muslims around the world.
Today, I want to appeal and reach out to all people and countries in the Muslim world. Let us work together in the spirit of mutual respect and tolerance. We need to solve this issue through dialogue, not violence.
Meanwhile, several Muslim groups continue to argue while they support freedom of expression, the cartoons were in poor taste. This is Dr. Issam Omesh, president of the Muslim American Society.
We vehemently stand by the freedom of the press and with the freedom of opinion. However, we say that with this freedom is responsibility in which there must be respect for other religions and the rights of others to stress that we are all part of one society. We want what's good for the whole society, and we don't want to disrespect the rights of one another.
In Britain, Muslim cleric Abu Hamza al-Masri has been sentenced to 7 years in prison for incitement of racial hatred and soliciting murder. Hamza is known for making fire attacks on Jews, Christians, and gays, but has never been shown to have direct links to violent acts. His sentence comes days after a British court acquitted Nick Griffin, leader of the rightist British National Party, of hate speech. Griffin was recorded calling Islam a, quote, wicked, vicious faith that, quote, has expanded through a handful of cranky lunatics and is now sweeping country after country. Masood Shadraha of the Islamic Human Rights Commission said, quote, compared with what has happened in the past few days, Nick Griffin and the Muhammad caricatures, Hamza's conviction has increased the perception in the Muslim community that freedom of speech is selective and access to justice is not blind, he said. In Israel, the interim Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has announced Israel will keep the three largest settlement blocks in the West Bank, home to more than 70,000 people. Palestinians say the settlements are illegal and prevent any chance for a viable future state. This week, the Israeli group Peace Now reported 12,000 new residents moved into West Bank settlements in 2005, 3,000 more than the total number removed as part of Israel's recent disengagement from the Gaza Strip. Back in the United States, four Alabama Baptist churches were set on fire Tuesday. The blazes come less than a week after suspicious fires damaged five churches in central Alabama. Police are investigating the fires as civil rights violations, but have declined to say whether they believe they may be hate crimes. Although all the churches that were torched Tuesday have predominantly black congregations, four of the five churches burned in last week's fires have predominantly white congregations. Police say witnesses have reported seeing two white males driving a black sport utility vehicle near both the areas where the fires have been set. On Capitol Hill, the Republican chair of the House subcommittee that oversees the National Security Agency has called for a full congressional inquiry into the Bush administration's domestic eavesdropping program. In a split with the White House, New Mexico Congressmember Heather Wilson, chair of the House Intelligence Subcommittee on Technical and Tactical Intelligence, told the New York Times, quote, she has serious concerns about the surveillance program. Wilson is the first Republican on either the House or Senate Intelligence Committee to call for a full congressional investigation into the program. Meanwhile, the conservative publication Insight on the News is reporting White House Deputy Chief of Staff Karl Rove is threatening any Republican Senate judiciary members who challenge the White House on domestic spying. According to Insight, sources said the blacklist would mean a halt in any White House political or financial support of senators running for re-election in November. A senior Republican aide told the publication, quote, it's hardball all the way. In New Orleans, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has begun evicting thousands of Katrina evacuees from government-paid hotel rooms. On Tuesday, occupants of more than 4,500 rooms were ordered to leave their hotels. FEMA officials say the agency will continue to pay for another 20,000 rooms until March 1st. Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco criticized the eviction, stating, quote, I'm troubled that FEMA has continued to reject the state's request for solutions, particularly in light of its failure to deliver temporary housing options to meet the needs of our Louisiana citizens. In other news, a presidential appointee at NASA's Public Affairs Department has resigned following the disclosure he fabricated parts of his resume. George Deutsch, who was appointed last year after working on President Bush's reelection campaign and inauguration, wrongly claimed he'd graduated with a journalism degree from Texas A&M University. Deutsch is one of several NASA officials accused by agency scientists of attempting to silence their warnings over the threats posed by global warming. In Washington, Knight Ridder is reporting the White House has conducted a major reorganization of the State Department that's marginalized several career international weapons experts in favor of less experienced political operatives who share the White House and Pentagon's distrust of international negotiations and treaties. According to current and former officials interviewed by Knight Ridder, the reorganizing has led to, quote, an exodus of experts with decades of experience in nuclear arms, chemical weapons, and related matters. In a joint letter, a group of State Department weapons experts said, quote, the process has been gravely flawed from the outset and smacks plainly of a political vendetta against career foreign service and civil service personnel by political appointees. In one case, the new Office of Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism circulated a job posting that listed loyalty to the priorities of President Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice as a job qualification. Some weapons analysts said the exodus is especially worrisome because of the pending expiration of the 1991 START 1 treaty, the only mechanism for verifying U.S. and Russian nuclear arms cuts. And in the eastern Papua province of Indonesia, scientists say they found what they call a lost world of dozens of exotic new species of birds, butterflies, frogs, and plants. This is Henk van Maastricht, an entomologist with Conservation International.
I am collecting 30 years in Papua, and I never collected so many new species in such a short time.
In indigenous communities living near the Foja Range say they've never ventured inside the untouched region. The discovered species include more than 20 new species of frog, 4 new species of butterfly, and several new species of plants. Scientists say the area is probably the largest pristine tropical forest in Asia. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. In Haiti, voters are awaiting the outcome of the first presidential election since the U.S.-backed ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide 2 years ago. There were no polling stations in Lavalas stronghold of Cité Soleil, home of at least 200,000 people. Voters swarmed out of that poor neighborhood, as well as Bel Air and other areas, to discover voting stations had failed to open. Election officials had no ballots. Registration lists were incorrect, and lines stretched for blocks. Angry crowds stormed the gates of the voting stations. At least 4 people died, including a police officer who was killed by a mob after fatally shooting a voter. In many polling centers, vote counting continued late in the night after doors remained open far longer than planned in order to accommodate voters still lined up outside. Thousands of armed U.N. troops were deployed to watch over the election process, which has been delayed 4 times since October. Official results are expected Friday. Voters in Haiti were choosing a new president as well as a 129-member parliament. The frontrunner in the election is an ally of President Aristide named René Préval. He served as Aristide's first prime minister and succeeded Aristide as president in 96. However, Préval never joined Aristide's political party, Lavalas. He said he would not prevent Aristide's return to Haiti. A factory owner named Charles-Henri Baker is polling second. He was the leader of the anti-Aristide group of 184 and is the only white candidate in the race. We go first to Haiti to speak with independent journalist Andrea Schmidt. She joins us on the ground from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andrea.
Thank you.
Can you describe what happened yesterday, Election Day, in Haiti?
Well, I want to say that to start the day at 4:30 and to roam the streets of Port-au-Prince was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, because it was extremely inspiring to see, after 2 years of political repression in many areas and human rights abuses and a further disintegrating infrastructure, to see Haitians come out to vote and to be in the streets lined up ready to vote by 5 a.m. It was extremely powerful. And then we arrived in Cité Soleil, or rather on the outskirts of Cité Soleil, because as you mentioned in the introduction, there was a decision made by the CEP, the Provisional Electoral Council, to not have voting stations inside Cité Soleil for alleged reasons of insecurity. But of course, there's always a question of how politically motivated these things are. So people had to leave their neighborhood and walk to the outskirts to one of 4 voting centers. And the scene when we arrived at Building the Maquette was again incredibly inspiring. 5 a.m., people waiting to vote. By 6 a.m., the voting stations, the polling booths were supposed to open. And there's, I believe, 43 different polling stations within that one voting center, which means that over 2,000 people, or two, sorry, 20,000 people would have been set to vote in that area. People became very, very impatient when they realized that it was 6 a.m. They wanted to vote before the sun got too hot, because they were in a warehouse area, no shade whatsoever except inside, and they realized that the voting booths hadn't even been set up yet. The questions about why these failures in logistical planning took place remain. One of the things I observed later on in the day was going up to Pétionville, going up up the hill to the wealthy areas of the city where voting was going on in a very orderly fashion, where people were able to go into a building, line up, vote within, you know, half an hour of arriving, is that if you plan to hold an election in a warehouse where there are no walls, and you assume that the poorest people in the city should have to use the poorest infrastructure in the city, you're going to have elections that look like people taping cardboard boxes up to create private polling spaces. You're going to have the sort of elections that are very, very vulnerable to all sorts of spoiling and a sort of disenfranchisement based on class. And that's what we observed yesterday. By about 8:30 in the morning at Binding de Minquatre, as far as I could observe, nobody had yet been able to vote. People became very frustrated. There was a remarkable demonstration of, I'd say, about 10,000 people that grew as it went from Cité Soleil, where it picked up people who had not yet been able to vote, up to Bel Air, and was about to go to the CEP headquarters on Delma when the demonstration turned around and people returned to their neighborhoods saying that they were going to try to vote again. And then, as you mentioned, polling stations closed about 2 hours later than foreseen, at least in Cité Soleil or in the environs where we were watching the closings. And again, some very poor infrastructure and security arrangements made for increased frustration, increased disenfranchisement, where, you know, people were basically having to wrestle with Jordanian soldiers who had been patrolling their neighborhoods shooting for several months.
Andrea Schmidt, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince in Haiti. As we turn now to Miami, where we're joined in a studio by Haitian Catholic priest Father Gérard-Jean Just. Last week, he was temporarily released from jail in Haiti in order to be treated for leukemia and pneumonia. He's been imprisoned for more than 6 months since July. Hundreds of religious, political, and human rights leaders and 50 members of the U.S. Congress have called on the interim Haitian government to release him. Amnesty International labeled him a prisoner of conscience. On Monday, Father Jean Just announced his support for the leading candidate, René Préval. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Father Jean Just.
Thank you very much.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling a little bit better, and I thank all of you, friends, religious people, people everywhere in different countries around the world, and legislators. I thank all of you and who helped me recuperate now. And I have received outstanding medical treatment at the Jackson Memorial Hospital. And so I'm so happy that so many people caring for me. And I want to remain grateful to all of you for my whole life.
Father Jean Just, can you share your response to the election that took place in your country as you are here in the United States right now?
Of course, that was my birthday present as I foresaw it. And the people have responded in big numbers, and they wanted to exercise their rights to vote, and they indeed have exercised it. I'm happy, and I hope that from now on, nobody should stop the Haitian people from enjoying the rights to vote. And also now, I hope that no one should try once more to go against the will of the people, because that created so much turmoil, such a chaotic situation we have lived since February 29, 2004. So we hope that everyone from now on
will have great respect for the poorest one, will have great respect for everyone, particularly those poorest people who are trying hard to get off misery and to organize themselves. And we have one more chance in history to regain our place as a nation and to contribute as our ancestors have contributed to freedom. So this is a great step in the right direction, and I congratulate everyone who helped us to live this great day, February 7, 2006.
Father Jean-Just, we last spoke to you on July 21st. You were headed to the funeral of a journalist named Jacques Roche. You were arrested after being attacked by a mob. They charged you with the murder of Jacques Roche, and you ended up more than 6 months in jail, temporary release right now for medical treatment. Can you describe what happened that day? I remember when we were talking to you, you said you were being followed at that point. We were talking to you in your car on the way to the funeral.
Yes, indeed. On my way to the church, I was followed by the police, and the siren going loud was distracting me while I was talking to you on the radio. So when I arrived at the church, and then I humbly wanted so much to offer my condolences and my comfort to the parents of Jacques Roche, to all the friends, because this is a brother that I didn't know personally, but after his death, I've learned a lot about him, and also knowing that his father is from the same town where I am from in Haiti, from Carvajal. And we have a good time in Carvajal, the family, Jean-Just family and the Walsh family. So I took the opportunity to go there to pray and accompany them. But unfortunately, there was a plot going on. I was not aware of it. And so they directed the mob at my direction, and then suddenly I saw myself surrounded in the church, at the sacristy of the church, and then I knelt down to pray. I said, God, I surrendered unto you my soul, because I was ready to accept death as one of the attackers have told me that what I see coming for you, Father, is bad. You better leave right away. And then as I was leaving, going backward, walking backward toward the sacristy and toward the rectory, the mob keep attacking me. And I was accompanied by attorney Bill Quigley, a volunteer attorney who had done great job to help us in the struggle. And then the mob keep coming on me, beating me all over my neck, beating me all over my shoulder. They threw some liquid at me, which was poured over my neck, and I didn't know what kind. Apparently, it was a chemical liquid. And also, at a certain time, I saw a young lady tearing the crowd, rushing toward me, jump on my neck, and with her rosary in her hand, and praying, and helping me to pray, and she was received the blows for me. And then someone has withdrawn a pick about 2 feet long, tried to stab me from my heart side, and the lady got in her jacket the pick that pierced a side of her and missed me. So that lady saved me. And, we moved back up the stairs to the rectory. And at the rectory, we hid ourselves at the ladies' restroom. And from there, the police and the MINUSTA and CIVPOL, the troops from the United Nations, they arrived and they told me that it's not safe to stay where I was because they were trying to burn the rectory. They have to take me away to the police commissariat. And I went to the police headquarters, even though a priest friend of mine said no. The priest is okay here at the rectory, and there will be no attack. Leave him here. And so the police force decided that to take me away to the police headquarters, which was about a mile from the rectory.
And they then arrested
I arrived there by 11:30 a.m. By 9:30 p.m., instead of letting me go home, me who has been the victim, and the attackers all have been left alone, going freely in the streets, and I was the one being arrested and thrown at the bell floor of the cell at the police station, rejoining about 44 other prisoners there. It was a tough day for me, without food, without drink, and beaten in very bad shape, and I had received no medication at all. There I was on the floor suffering. And then the next day, they brought me to the main penitentiary where they put me in isolation, which has been a kind of tomb under a heavy set of building brick. So they call it Titanic. And there I spent over a month where I keep fainting. I couldn't survive until the prisoners take good care of me. They brought me up on their shoulders to the clinic, to the medical clinic. There I received some treatment. And from that day, I decided to go on hunger strike for many reasons, because the deportees are found in a section of the jail where there nobody knew about them, and they had no hope at all. And also some prisoners were sick. Instead of receiving treatment, they were maltreated, and also overcrowding situation at the jail, and some youngsters dying, and some of them who suffered for mental sickness. Instead of receiving care, they punished them further. That was heartbroken for me.
Father Jean-Just, when you were held in prison for the 6 months, there was word that you were going to run for president, but that the interim government, the unelected government, said because they had jailed you, you could not run. Is that right?
But that's what amazed me. I didn't know that I was so popular in Haiti. And the government, it seems that they have made some kind of survey. They tried to trap me before election. I didn't know that. Even the Bishop of Port-au-Prince, who is a good friend of mine, Monsignor Muir, Bishop Muir, he advised me not to go around, to stay at the church, because they're plotting something against me. And it happened just that day. I couldn't hold it. I went to the church. But it is true. They knew that something could happen. But myself, I was not aware of it, to talk to you frankly. And when I was in jail, and suddenly listening to the radio, I heard the people who have been demonstrating for my freedom, instead of saying freedom for me, they say that they want me to be their candidate. I was so surprised. I was shocked. I was happy too. Because to tell you frankly, I was not looking to become a candidate, to become a president. But I flirt with that idea once in a while, especially when the reporters are after me. So it's a good feeling.
Ultimately, though, Father Jean-Just, you supported René Préval, who is considered the front runner in this election. It is said he would allow President Aristide to return home. Have you spoken to President Aristide?
Yes, indeed. From July up until January 29, I did not, from July 2005 to January 2006, I have not spoken to President Aristide. I wanted so much to talk to him. We tried to correspond. I tried to sneak a phone into the prison cell, a cellular phone, trying badly to talk to him. I failed. Somebody else got the phone, and he was punished. The other prisoner was punished, but he didn't catch me with it. But I finally talked to President Aristide. I was so happy the other day when I talked to him. And I talked to the First Lady also, Mildred.
Do you expect President Aristide to return to Haiti?
Oh, definitely. That's his right. That's his right. Because the Constitution of Haiti does not allow to keep any Haitian in exile. Even Jean-Claude Duvalier, baby doc, if he wants to return to Haiti, he should be able to return to Haiti.
And will you, Father Jean-Just, return? You've been temporarily released for your health treatment.
As my good doctors, Dr. Paul Farmer, Dr. Anne, and many others who are treating me now, Dr. Jennifer Fuhrer, ask them, if they tell me, hey, Jerry, you can go home now, I will try to book a reservation and go home immediately.
And the
this is the first time since many years I've missed such a big event in Haiti.
I'm going to ask, the former Prime Minister, Van Neptune, still in prison, in the same prison you were held at the National Penitentiary?
Yes. We were held together during my first arrestation at the National Penitentiary, but they tried to separate us because whenever they see us together, they think that we're plotting something. So when I arrived this time, where we have been in jail together, and they said, I have no right to visit him. But, you know, knowing me, I sneak in once in a while without permission. And then we managed to correspond by letters. We write a lot of letters to each other. Almost every day we keep writing each other.
We only
have... He refused to eat. He's in danger now. I'm afraid for my brother, Yvon Neptune, because since 8 months, he consumed no solid food, only liquid water and some vitamins.
Father Jean,
I don't know how he survived.
Father Jean-Just, we only have 30 seconds, but I want to ask you, if you return to Haiti, will you be re-imprisoned?
Prison or not, I love to be back to Haiti. Because this is where the action is taking place. I love people around here, too. I want to tell my brothers and sisters, all my friends, I love you all. Margaret Truss, who has been helping us with the food, with the Wadi Foundations, and so many other people helping me from U.S. And also, let me take this minute to say a special thanks to Amnesty International. I received over 4,000 letters from December until January. And coming from Canada, coming from Europe, and coming from big United States, all over. I'm so happy about that. That's helped the prisoners so much. Even the other prisoners share my letters. They took some of my cards and placed by the bed and were happy. So thanks to you all who are concerned about the prisoners, the lawyers, and everybody else.
Father Jean-Just.
Brian Concannon, and everybody else.
I want to thank you very much for being with us and speaking to us from Miami, where you've been released to receive medical treatment. Thank you.
You're right.
Father Gerard Jean-Just, imprisoned in Haiti for more than 6 months, now in the United States, hoping to return very soon to his home in Haiti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, the funeral of Coretta Scott King.
Oh,
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An estimated 10,000 people filled the pews of New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta suburb of Lithonia yesterday for the funeral of civil rights pioneer Coretta Scott King. Among the mourners, family members and friends, four U.S. presidents, former Presidents Carter, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and President George W. Bush attended the funeral along with 14 U.S. senators, Maya Angelou, Oprah Winfrey, Stevie Wonder. Coretta Scott King died January 30th at the age of 78, seeking treatment in Mexico for ovarian cancer. Throughout the 40 years following the assassination of her husband, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Coretta Scott King was an outspoken opponent of injustice, ranging from capital punishment to apartheid in South Africa. Also a vocal advocate of women's rights, gay and lesbian rights, and HIV/AIDS prevention. In 2003, Coretta Scott King also spoke out against the invasion of Iraq. At yesterday's funeral, both former President Jimmy Carter and Reverend Joseph Lowery, the former head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, made pointed criticism of President Bush's policies as he sat on the podium. They cited the war in Iraq and civil liberties transgressions, also accused the president of ignoring the plight of the U.S. poor. President George W. Bush, one of the first of the 39 speakers to take the podium at yesterday's funeral. After he spoke, he was followed by Reverend Joseph Lowery, co-founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with Dr. Martin Luther King. He made a subtle attack on the Bush administration's war in Iraq and cuts in social programs.
What a family reunion. Rosa and Martin were reminiscing. They'd just begun to talk. When Martin seemed not to listen, he started to walk. The wind had whispered in his ear, I believe somebody is almost here. Excuse me, Rosa, Martin said as he did depart. His soul was on fire. He just couldn't wait. His spirit leaped with joy as he moved toward the pearly gates. Glory, glory, hallelujah. And after 40 years, almost 40 years, Together at last, thank God Almighty. Together at last. Thank you, Coretta. Didn't she carry her grief with dignity? Her growing influence with humility? She secured his seed, nurtured his nobility. She declared humanity's worth and vented their vision, his and hers, for peace in all the earth. She opposed discrimination based on race. She frowned on homophobia and gender bias she rejected on its face. She summoned the nations to study war no more. She embraced the oneness of the human family from shore to shore. Excuse me, Maya. She extended Martin's message against poverty, racism, and war. She deplored the terror inflicted by our smart bums on missions way afar. We know now there were no weapons of mass destruction over there. That there are weapons of misdirection right down here. Millions without health insurance. Poverty abounds. For war, billions more, but no more for the poor. Well, Coretta had harsh critics, some no one could please, but she paid them no mind. She kept speaking for the least of these. Now I'm about through. As we get old, or so I'm told, We listen in to heaven like the prophets of old. I heard Martin and Coretta say, do us a favor, Joe. Those four little children I spoke of in 63, they're fine adults now, as all can see. They already know, but tell them again. We love them so dear. Assure them we'll always be near their troubles to bless and sanctify to them their deepest distress. Tell them we believe in them as we know you do. We know their faith in God and their love for each other will see them through. Assure them at the end of the tunnel awaits God's light, and we are confident that they will always strive for the right. Tell them don't forget to remember that we're as near as their prayer and never afar, and we can rest in peace because they know who and whose they are. What a family reunion. Thank you, Lord. Just the other day, I thought I heard you say, Coretta, my child, come on home. You've earned your rest. Your body is weary. You've done your best. Her witness and character always strong. Her spirit a melody from heaven's song. Her beauty warm like the rays of the sun. Good night, my sister. Well done. Well done.
The Reverend Joseph Lowery speaking at the funeral of Coretta Scott King. When we come back from break, we'll hear former President Jimmy Carter, Maya Angelou, and the daughter of Coretta Scott King, Bernice. But first, Stevie Wonder sang at the funeral.
His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches over me.
Stevie Wonder singing at the funeral of Coretta Scott King. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Writer, activist, poet Maya Angelou also spoke.
I open my mouth to the Lord and I won't turn back, no. I will go. I shall go. I'll see what the end is gonna be. In the midst of national tumult, in the median of international violent uproar, Coretta Scott King's face remained a study in serenity. In times of interior violent storms, she sat, her hands resting in her lap calmly, like good children sleeping. Her passion was never spent in public display. She offered her industry and her energies to action toward righting ancient and current wrongs in this world. She believed religiously in nonviolent protest. She believed it could heal a nation mired in a history of slavery and all its excesses. She believed nonviolent protest religiously could lift up a nation rife with racial prejudices
and racial bias. She was the quintessential African-American woman, born in the small town, repressive South, born of flesh and destined to become iron, born a cornflower and destined to become a steel magnolia. She loved her church fervently. She loved and adored her husband and her children. She cherished her race. She cherished women. She cared for the conditions of human beings, of Native Americans and Latinos and Asian Americans. She cared for gay and straight people. She was concerned for the struggles in Ireland, and she prayed nightly for Palestine and equally for Israel. I speak as a sister of a sister. Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated on my birthday. And for over 30 years, Coretta Scott King and I have telephoned or sent cards to each other, or flowers to each other, or met each other somewhere in the world. We called ourselves chosen sisters. And when we traveled to South Africa or to the Caribbean, or when she came to visit me in North Carolina or in New York, we sat into the late evening hours calling each other girl. Now, that's a black woman thing, you know. And even as we reached well into our 70th decade, we still said girl. I stand here today for her family, which is my family. And for my family and all the other families in the world who would want to be here but could not be here. I have beside me up here millions of people who are living and standing straight and erect and knowing something about dignity without being cold and aloof, knowing something about being contained without being unapproachable. People who have learned something from Coretta Scott King. I stand here for Eleanor Traylor and for Harry Belafonte, and I stand here for Winnie Mandela. I stand here for women and men who loved her. Dinky Romilly. On those late nights when Coretta and I would talk, I would make her laugh. And she said that Martin King used to tell her, "You don't laugh enough." And there's a recent book out about sisters in which she spoke about her blood sister. But at the end of her essay, she said, I do have a chosen sister, Maya Angelou, who makes me laugh even when I don't want to. And it's true, I told her some jokes only for no mixed company. Many times on those late afternoon evenings, she would say to me, "Sister, it shouldn't be an either or, should it? Peace and justice should belong to all people everywhere all the time. Isn't that right?" And I said then, and I say now, Coretta Scott King, you're absolutely right. I do believe that peace and justice should belong to every person, everywhere, all the time. And those of us who gather here, principalities, presidents, senators, those of us who run great companies, who know something about being parents, who know something about being preachers and teachers, those of us, we owe something from this minute on, so that this gathering is not just another footnote on the pages of history. We owe something. I pledge to you, my sister, I will never cease. I mean to say, I want to see a better world. I mean to say, I want to see some peace somewhere. I mean to say, I want to see some honesty, some fair play. I want to see kindness and justice. This is what I want to see, and I want to see it through my eyes and through your eyes, Coretta Scott King. I open my mouth to the Lord, and I won't turn back, no. I will go. I shall go. I'll see what the end is going to be. Thank you.
Maya Angelou, poet, writer, leader, speaking at Coretta Scott King's funeral. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter also spoke.
My life has been closely intertwined with that of the King family. Our first ceremony together was in 1974 when, as governor, I dedicated Martin's portrait in the Georgia Capitol. Joe Lowry and others were there. Which was surrounded outside with chanting members of the Ku Klux Klan who had too much support from other Americans. The efforts of Martin and Coretta have changed America. They were not appreciated even at the highest level of government. It was difficult for them personally, with the civil liberties of both husband and wife violated as they became the targets of secret government wiretapping, other surveillance. And as you know, harassment from the FBI. This commemorative ceremony this morning and this afternoon is not only to acknowledge the great contributions of Coretta and Martin, but to remind us that the struggle for equal rights is not over. We only have to recall the color of the faces of those in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. Most devastated by Katrina, to know that they are not yet equal opportunities for all Americans. It is our responsibility to continue their crusade. I would like to say to my sister Coretta that we will miss you, but our sorrow is alleviated by the knowledge that you and your husband are united in glory. Thank you for what you've meant to me and to the world.
Former President Jimmy Carter. Bernice King, the youngest daughter of Coretta Scott King, delivered the eulogy.
It wasn't the stroke that took her. In the natural sense of the word. But it was the complications from ovarian cancer, which caused respiratory pneumonia, that took her. And the Lord had me to look back on that, and He took me to a scripture where a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews, came to Jesus at nighttime. And he said, "Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God. For no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot, she cannot see the kingdom of God." And I said, "God, why are you taking me there?" He said, because it is no accident and mistake that the very thing that took your mother out here, ovarian cancer, is a message that emerges from that kind of death for people all over the nations for such a time as this. For you see, her cancer, in other words, was concentrated in the reproductive area, the reproductive system. And God took me back to there, and he showed me how the cancer was just growing in that reproductive area, and it was beginning to affect other organs in that vicinity. And he reminded me, he said, your mother passed away of complications from ovarian cancer, respiratory pneumonia, because right now my earth, my world, my nations are on the verge of losing it and dying and being overtaken with respiratory pneumonia failure because of complications from reproductive cancer. And those complications are hindering the ability for a new birth. See, what God is saying to us today through the transition of Coretta Scott King is that we here in this world right now are suffering from a complications of cancer from materialism and greed and selfishness and arrogance and elitism and poverty and racism and perversion and obscenity and misogyny and idolatry and violence and militarism. It's a cancer that is eating away at the very essence and the nature of what God created humankind to be. For he created us to have rulership and dominion in the earth and not allow the earth to dictate to us. But now what has happened is that the very earth, the very creation that he put us in charge of, is now controlling us. And instead of us reproducing other people who look like God, who talk like God, who act like God, who think like God, who do business like God, who govern like God, who entertain like God, we are not reproducing anything because the cancer is eating away at us.
And that was Bernice King, the youngest daughter of Coretta and Martin Luther King, at the funeral of Coretta Scott King. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hubdo Kadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. And I